This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montagne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Audiences around the world have a chance to see Michael Jackson's last performance. It's a documentary made of rehearsal footage from the huge show he was planning for London when he died. The film is called This Is It. Despite the finality of that title, we can expect to see a lot more of Jackson's work, as Nate DeMeo reports.
Kenny Ortega had worked with Michael Jackson for 2 years developing the This Is It stage show. And when its promoter came to him and asked him to turn footage of that process into a film, he hesitated. His friend had just died.
I didn't feel that I'd have the creative objectivity to step into an editing room and sort of face this material so quickly.
But he says as he sat watching the footage, he felt like he didn't have a choice.
I was there. I knew what the story was. This was sacred. And that it sort of was my responsibility to continue forward with the journey.
The result of that journey, that several months spent in the dark editing booth, is now opening on 11,000 screens all over the world.
There's the man.
There's Michael.
Woo! The man is here.
We're all here because of him. May that continue with him leading the way.
This is the moment. This is it.
Box office prognosticators project good returns for Columbia Pictures, the movie studio that placed a $60 million bet on Ortega's documentary. Prognosticators of the earnings of dead celebrities, yes, such people exist, project that the next 2 years will be incredibly lucrative for the Jackson estate.
You're talking about the level of the Beatles and Elvis Presley and Michael Jackson and Frank Sinatra. These are the icons of the icons in the pop world.
Jeff Jampol manages The Doors and Janis Joplin. Not used to manage. He manages everything. He approves and rejects licenses. He times album re-releases. He tries to get the artists on the covers of magazines. And it can be a perilous business.
Literally, I could ruin in an afternoon what it took these guys 30 years, 40 years to build.
And then there are all the other people who the official gatekeepers have no control over.
As his friend, I do feel a certain responsibility for his image, of course.
Rabbi Shmuley Boteik is one of the many parties outside of the official Jackson circle who will be profiting from Jackson's image. He recently released a book drawn from recorded conversations with Jackson. Boteik calls it a raw look at a complicated man, even though he says that might frustrate the people in charge of maintaining the Michael Jackson brand.
Their principal objective is to ensure the financial integrity of the estate. I'm not sure that they have made it their priority to ensure the integrity of Michael's image.
All we can do is put our faith in the family and in the estate that they're going to be smart and selective.
Kenny Ortega says he worries about what will happen to his friend and collaborator now that Jackson isn't here to guide his own career. But he says he's been encouraged by what he experienced during the process of getting his documentary to the screen.
Do I have complete faith and utter confidence? No, I don't. I don't. You know, but I can say that the experience that I've been through has shown some promise.
It appears that decisions about how, and importantly, how often, Jackson's image and music will be used will primarily be made by two men, John McClain and John Branca. Both are longtime veterans of the music industry in the Michael Jackson industry. The Doors manager, Jeff Jampol, says the two men have an incredible opportunity in front of them. With most artists, the big fear is going too big, licensing too many products and diluting the brand through overexposure. But this is Michael Jackson.
I think you have an obligation to do things on a huge superstar worldwide level. In the case of Michael Jackson, I don't think you can go too big or too exposed.
In other words, the King of Pop is dead. Long live the King of Pop. For NPR News, I'm Nate DeMeo.
The musician Thomas Lauderdale built a successful career, yet he's still taking piano lessons. That classical music, heard here on an old recording, grew into a song of Lauderdale's own. The way it did tells you something about the creative process of Lauderdale's band, Pink Martini. Lauderdale and his colleagues assembled a song the way that you might make a collage. In fact, that classical composition became a pair of songs on their new album, Splendor in the Grass. The process begins with Lauderdale, his producer, and a chance encounter with some sheet music.
The Schubert was lying out on my piano, and somehow we were sort of like singing along with the melody, and just the phrase, "and then you're gone," kind of popped in. And that's how it all sort of unfolded, just from that, from the Schubert and from the phrase, "and then you're gone."
So they had a melody, they had a refrain, and they made this.
my dear Lorenzo, you take my hand and understand the tears that I have cried. We light the candles and pour the wine and laugh as if you'll never leave my side. You take me in your arms and tell me that I'll always be the only one. And then you're gone.
Pink Martini is a creation of Lauderdale and China Forbes, the singer we're hearing now. They became famous mixing different styles of music. Plenty of people do that, of course, but Pink Martini seems to do it with one eyebrow raised, so you're never quite sure if they're joking.
You come to see me on a Saturday presenting peonies, knowing just what to say.
What's happening in that song?
Well, it takes the theme from Fantasy for Piano for Four Hands by Franz Schubert in F minor, and then suddenly it becomes a Latin beat sort of kicks in, and it becomes somewhere between I Will Survive, Shirley Bassey, and Schubert, and a tango.
What else can you throw in? I mean, some cupcakes.
The idea was to sort of, like, you know, it's sort of a, I'm not going to take it anymore kind of song. The opposite of that Shirley Bassey song, I Who Have Nothing. Mm. This is sort of like, I've got a lot and get lost.
Did you start with a different kind of song than you finished with?
Yes.
I mean, I have, you know.
It was long and repetitive. We cut it down.
You know, the day that I tried to introduced this song to the band, they were not, nobody was happy.
It's a process, Steve.
And so we were sort of forlorn and ran away, and we started thinking about what if we did it to a swing beat? And suddenly we had not one but two songs. So it was like, you know, if you think this is repetitive, try this.
Well, let's play a little bit of the second song where we hear from the love interest who's walked out on you, China Forbes, but has come back briefly. And I should mention for our listeners, this is an NPR correspondent who'll be very familiar to some of our listeners. And just listen a little bit and see if you can figure out who it is.
My dear Maria, I'm here to see you. Won't you please, please open the door? I brought you flowers, been waiting hours, can't stand it anymore. So here's what happened when you were napping. I just went out for a snack. I was feeling famished, and then I vanished. But now I'm back.
Pink Martini from their new recording, the second of a pairing of songs. The first from a woman singing about a man who's gone. The second a man announcing that he's back. And I told you that voice was an NPR correspondent. That correspondent is with us now. And, sir, would you please give us your NPR out cue?
Ari Shapiro, NPR News.
Justice correspondent and frequent guest host here on Morning Edition. How on earth did you end up on this recording?
I'm still trying to figure that one out.
You guys are old friends. We should say that. Yeah. You've known each other.
We both grew up in Portland, and so we've known each other for years. And in June, the band came to Washington, D.C. for a show. And I threw a dinner party for them and a bunch of D.C. friends and some other Portland folks. And the party turned into somehow a sing-along in the upstairs of my house around the piano. And the next day, sitting at my desk at NPR, Thomas calls me, and he says, "Will you do a song on the next album?" And I say this with love, Thomas tends to come up with sort of cockamamie, harebrained ideas that could never actually take place, that somehow he manages to actually make happen.
Typical Pink Martini experience.
Is it? Really?
Kind of. Sometimes.
Sometimes it could be really by the seat of our pants, which is kind of, you know, it makes it exciting.
That's how your pants get so many holes in them.
Keeps them on their toes.
Come on, this is morning radio.
Oh, sorry.
I'm not really a songwriter. China's more really of a songwriter than I am. My urge is more to just practice Schubert and try to become better.
I wonder, Mr. Lauderdale, if the word for you would be less a songwriter than a composer. And I mean that in a slightly different way than people would talk about a composer of music. You seem to compose instruments, compose people, pull different thoughts and ideas together that you get different places and rearrange them in new ways.
Or maybe like a ringmaster.
We're in a circus.
I guess so.
I don't want to be in a circus.
Well, the ringleader would be more like, you know.
I liked composer. I think you're right. You know, composition in a painting, composition.
Right.
It's like a tableau, and Thomas is actually moving the figurines around. And
isn't that just called set
things.
Decorator?
Interior designer.
Interior designer.
You're all of it. Pastry chef.
I can do all of it.
Now just be
Thomas Lauderdale and China Forbes lead Pink Martini, whose new album is Splendor in the Grass. It features a guest appearance by NPR's Ari Shapiro and includes two songs inspired by a classical composition by Franz Schubert. And you can hear both those songs at nprmusic.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne.
Betty Davis, spelt with an E at the end of Betty, was of course a famous film actress. But there is another Betty Davis, spelt with a Y, who is a funk singer and ex-wife of the late jazz trumpeter Miles Davis. In 1975, she tried to break into the mainstream with an album called Nasty Gal. Despite critical acclaim, the album never achieved commercial success, and now Nasty Gal is getting another chance. It's been reissued. Our reviewer Meredith Oakes says the album was ahead of its time.
Betty Davis's openly sexy growl conjures images of the way she looked on stage in the 70s. Thigh-high silver boots, hot pants, massive afro. Davis was Sly Stone, Mick Jagger, and the Jimi Hendrix Experience all rolled into one woman. Sly Stone bassist Larry Graham once said that although Davis didn't play anything, her mind, body, and spirit were her instruments. On this album's title track, you can hear that her singing isn't just a voice. It's a supernatural force she's using to break social conventions, push funk to the extreme, and propel herself as an artist. By the time Nasty Gal was recorded, Betty Davis and her band were a tight unit. Their act finally honed over many months on the road. She wasn't just a woman fronting a group of musicians. She was part of the band, but she was also the leader in every way. The music, the clothes, the choreography, Davis controlled the whole package, uncompromising in her vision. Aggressive and outrageous, she challenged the notions of what women could do and say on and off the stage.
What I am. Hey, no!
Betty Davis could use her vocal power for ballads just as easily as belting, and on Nasty Gal, she proved that she wasn't a one-dimensional screamer. This song marked the public reconciliation with her ex-husband, Miles Davis. She co-wrote the song with Davis about their relationship. Punctuated by his distinct trumpet playing, it's even more poignant.
I'm just a child trying.
This album was poised to be Betty Davis's commercial breakthrough, but it didn't work out that way. She left the business shortly after its release and moved to Pennsylvania, where she still resides. Some say that her image upstaged her music, but I disagree.
listening to the propulsive funk and powerful ensemble playing, all driven by this astonishing woman, it's apparent that her image was just as important to the albums as a guitar or a keyboard or her voice. Her image was the very concept from which her music stemmed. In 1975, Betty seemed to represent the era, but she probably pushed boundaries too far from mainstream music. And artists at the forefront of their art are seldom appreciated until the rest of the world catches up.
The reissued album from Betty Davis is called Nasty Gal. Our reviewer, Meredith Oakes, is a talk show host and DJ with Sirius Satellite Radio.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Music video games are among the world's most popular, earning billions of dollars, selling to gamers who delight in shredding through a song by Jimi Hendrix or Aerosmith. NPR's Netta Ulaby says the company that makes Guitar Hero is tweaking that franchise with a new game that comes out tomorrow.
The game is called DJ Hero, and it's about as true to actual DJing as Guitar Hero is to actual rock stardom. Jamie Jackson is creative director of Freestyle Games, that developed both DJ and Guitar Hero.
It's not about you being a DJ and simulating. That wasn't the idea. It's about having fun and feeling like you're controlling the party. So all the music is pre-made by our DJs.
Meaning it's a pre-mixed, pre-sampled, pre-beat-matched assortment of popular tunes. Freestyle developers worked with about 20 DJs to figure out how to turn turntabling into something playable on an Xbox. It works like Guitar Hero, but instead of that plastic guitar, you get a fake turntable and a fake little mixer, while a funky DJ avatar struts, cuts, and scratches on screen.
He is enjoying himself.
Robert Carter is a DJ who plays nationally under the name DJ Cousin B. By day, you'll find him including audio for NPR's website. I asked him to play DJ Hero.
It takes some getting used to, but then again, this is a game.
Freestyle Games recruited a few illustrious DJs to add cred.
It's your boy, DJ Grandmaster Flash. I'm going to be a professor.
Okay, you got Flash on here, okay. So it's official.
Now let's talk about tapping.
I've never had Flash teach me how to DJ, so let's do it.
We decided to pit DJ Cousin B against a gamer, NPR intern Brian Reardon.
You're overthinking it. You just got to move it. Just moving it back and forth.
Yeah, I'm overthinking it. I'm at an NPR, not the club.
DJ Cousin B was experiencing the same problems some guitar players have with Guitar Hero. Real skills don't translate. They confuse you.
That's weird. Because you normally don't scratch with just one finger, so it's really strange, but okay.
When Freestyle Games first developed DJ Hero, creative director Jamie Jackson asked regular people what they thought DJs did.
99% of them put one hand to their ear and the other made a scratching sound and kind of went, wicka, wicka, wicka.
See, I mean, I don't know anything about turntables, and I'm sure, like I have no idea what this, I've never known what guys are doing when they do that.
Gamer Brian Reardon still utterly destroys the DJ in this virtual battle. Robert Carter is a fabulous DJ in real life. He's not fabulous at scoring points in the game's glamorous industrial nightclub.
You are just stinking up the joint.
They just booed me.
Oh, you didn't even get one star.
I didn't get a star, man. They booed me.
Is there anything about this that's like actual DJing?
DJs fantasize for an environment like this. You have about 30,000 people out there going crazy. I mean, it's everybody's reacting. No fights out there.
DJ Cousin B, a.k.a. Robert Carter, says this game is perfect if you want to one-up a DJ.
Say, man, like, you know, I think you would be nice at DJ Hero. Let me check you out. And you just kill him.
Still, Carter plans to get the game for his little 8-year-old nephew. In a few years, he says, he'll teach him how to DJ for real. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.